バラすわよ。
If I bend my youth, would it come to me? Oh, love, won't you bat my eye? I miss the sweet garden man, baffled a skeleton drive. All they wanted was a villain, and all they had was me. All they wanted was a villain, so then they just took me.
Yeah. had an appetite for starlight.
Under the billion watt blink of a sleepless city, she could make out the silhouettes of constellations. Trace them behind her teeth with her tongue, like how you spell a song with just your body. Lullabied her into awakening, into her place in constellations that hold up heaven and inspire girls like her to dance. Despite and because of the lovelessness that built the buildings that try to scrape away at sunrise, she was alive. Like every river we dam, every tree we cut, like every land we mine, every buffalo we kill, like every fruit we poison, every forest we pave, like every mountain we carve, like every breath we take. She is alive, like the stars, and gathers them one by one, places them beneath her tongue, and spends her lifetime revolving around the sun that she might understand the meaning of the life. And we all realize the meaning of our lives and live as if life depended on the gifts we try to hide.
Time. Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that was Climbing Poetry, She Lives. And we opened with Zion Trinity's Legba opening prayer, and that was followed by Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, We the Common. We are going to be playing a couple of shows from the archives. This morning, we had expected to speak to Leroy Moore, poet, and Simon Manda, journalist and publisher of Disability. It's a disability awareness newspaper. And Leroy Moore is getting ready to do a South African tour, art and activism tour. So we're having to postpone that conversation. However, stay tuned. So in the meantime, we're going to play a couple of interviews, one with director Billy Woodbury, about both of these interviews that we're going to play are about 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And Billy Woodbury, phenomenal director, well known for his work in documentary filmmaking. And we're going to be talking to him about Bless Their Little Hearts, which was a part of a program screened at Pacific Film Archive about 4 years ago, October 2012, and then we're going to follow that interview with another one with director Lavinia Currier. The film is called Oka, American Living with African Bayaka, Central African Community. So, and that particular interview was first aired October 14, 2011. So enjoy the archival interviews and look forward to your visiting with us for our regular show on Wednesday, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Pacific time. So I was wondering if you could tell us first, Mr. Woodbury, about sort of the whole idea of what brought you into filmmaking. I read that you're, you know, were born in Dallas, Texas. Were you raised there too?
Until I was 17, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I just love the name of the series that was in Los Angeles during the what was it called? The LA Standard, LA Rebellion. Because I was in Los Angeles and I couldn't stay long enough to be able to catch in the films, and I'm so happy that it's on tour. Not all of the films, but quite a few of them. And I just love the way the various directors, you all work on each other's films, and you're in some of each other's films, and you do the music, you know, one person's doing the music on somebody else's film, and then the next person's film, you know, you see them as cinematographers. So it's really cool. So why don't you talk about that whole image making that was sort of seemed really flourishing at the time you were at the in LA at the School of Film and Video.
Okay, where to start? I think what happened is, first of all, I think that term or that concept and idea was started by a scholar and a writer named Clyde Taylor, who at the time lived in the Bay Area and taught at Berkeley. And he used to publish reviews and articles about film in different places, but one place was Black Collegian. And then later in the 80s, he did a presentation at the Whitney Museum in New York, and this was the concept and idea that he came up with for his talk and to encapsulate his thinking about what happened in Los Angeles during the 1970s and early 80s or whatever. And then he sort of proposed that these films came out of the UCLA School of Film and Television at the time, from young people that were studying in graduate school and undergraduate school at the University of California, Los Angeles. And so then that concept got taken up, that idea and that label got taken up by different programmers, curators, and other younger scholars started to investigate it and write about it and think about it and that kind of thing. And then finally, after years, the UCLA Film and Television Archive was able to mount this big exhibition, relatively large, 51 films or something like that, at the Hammer Museum over some months in the fall of last year. And now it's sort of touring around. Myself, what happened was, I suppose, after... In some ways, you know, I mean, the 60s and all of that in the country and in the world was a kind of tumultuous time. And also, it's post the civil rights movement, the black consciousness movement, black power movement. It's, you know, an aftermath of that that we came to study film. And but the thing is that was a time, I think, of great optimism and also unprecedented opportunities and access for some younger people and others in the black community as a consequence of the struggles of the civil rights movement and the black consciousness movement. In the United States, the social movements, wider social movements, the movements against the war in Vietnam and for social justice and that kind of thing. I think one consequence in the black, among the black community or the black population or African American later, this is the term, is that there was a great optimism because for the first time people were gaining access and experiences that were beyond what could have been imagined 10, 15, 20 years before. And I think that optimism encouraged people to widen their interest, their curiosity, and that kind of thing. Another thing that happened in the early 70s is there was a whole... I mean, there was a kind of popular, in the popular commercial film world, they started to take on black subject matter, and they tried to respond to and ultimately, you know, exploit for their own purposes some of the... You know, the presence of and the sort of new recognition and the sort of prevalence of black cultural figures and cultural expression and new sort of attitudes and new ways of self-representation and that kind of thing. And so movies started to come out during this, you know, in this popular commercial movies that played in the big theaters and all the big inner cities and urban places in the U.S. There were some unique and singular examples that also came about in the commercial and in the independent, what became the independent film expression as it grew and developed in the early 70s, late 60s. If you think about it, people like Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, who had been actors in movies since the 50s and that kind of thing, like Sidney Poitier started to direct films. His first film, which I saw recently, actually watched the whole thing and found it quite an admirable movie. And it touched on many of the themes that preoccupied even some of my peers. But I don't know that we would have recognized it as such at the time. That film, Buck and the Preacher.
Oh, yeah, know? I like that film.
And as a matter of fact, one of our schoolmates, Pamela Jones, who acts in the film, in a number of the films, Ben Caldwell's film and Larry Clark's film. She acted in the movie, okay? She plays a young woman who's taken hostage, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really ask her much. She was also in another film that they made at the time, made by a former Blacklist director. I think it was Jules Dessin.
Hmm.
Who ended up after, you know, going to Europe in the Blacklist, and he ended up marrying Melina Mercouri, the Greek actress, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but he made a film called Uptight, which was a remake of a John Ford movie, you know,
mm-hmm.
with Raymond St. Jacques, and Tamela was also in that film. So, okay, that was going on. Then you had the initiative of people like Mr. Melvin Van Peebles, who came back from France after years living in Europe, and he made a film at Columbia, Warner Brothers, or one of them, called Watermelon Man.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, he built the...
That was good with Godfrey Cambridge.
Yeah, he built the conditions for himself to even strike out in a more original way and make a film that probably wouldn't have been acceptable at the time in the studio system. But he made his own film. It's called Sweet, Sweet Back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those films were coming out. Then Mr. Gordon Parks, he made the popular movie with a, you know, striking urban hero guy, you know, in cool mm-hmm. clothes and great soundtrack by Isaac Hayes, a chef movie, right?
Right?
So those movies were around. Then Mr. Parks had made earlier his autobiographical film, The Learning Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And those things. So people were doing that. The other thing for us, though, I think, and so, I mean, it was obvious and apparent that there was no sort of, it was possible for people of our type, our so-called race, we could do this. It was not a deficit that we had, right? And others, we learned later, right, about other examples and that kind of thing. But at the time, it seems possible to do things. And I was not in the first group of these people. People like Charles Burnett had already suspected that you could do it, right? And he had wanted to be a cameraman, and he ended up in film school. He did an undergraduate degree in film, and then he did a master's in film. And Larry Clark, Haile Gerima, and all those people ended up here at UCLA. So they were sort of first and second group. And then others of us started to suspect maybe it's an interesting thing to try. It was not unique to us because since the 1950s, after the Second World War, since the time of the Italian neorealist people who impressed upon the world that you didn't need all the huge infrastructure and apparatus to make a film. You didn't really, it didn't really require that the people be professional, that they be stars or that they be professional actors, you know, that one could make a film without those things and one could maybe get closer to a certain kind of reality without them, right? So you had that example. Then you had the exciting example of the French New Wave and all that followed throughout the world, right? In Japan and all India and all different places, you know, there was a change about, change of foot in cinema. And we were, you know, so we sort of followed in the wake of that. We followed in the wake of the new Latin American cinema, the new Cuban cinema, new African cinema, you know, begun by Ousmane Sembène and Suleiman Cissé and Omar Gonda and all of those people in Africa, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, fortunately for us, we were able, through some of the initiative of one faculty member here, Alessio Taylor, and then later one of our colleagues, but who became one of the leading thinkers and writers about this, Tshomi Gabriel. We pretty soon organized so that we had access to a lot of this new cinema that was coming from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And that was very inspiring and reassuring and gave us permission to try something, you see. And then we discovered, because we had the privilege of being at film school, which had enormous resources you know, relatively speaking, compared to what we had access to before. But it also had the archives, the memory of the cinema, and we had courses on the history of cinema, and we had courses on the work of Charlie Chaplin and all these things. And so you could be in an environment where, if you wanted to, you could be inundated and swim in images and film, like, you know, for 12 hours a day, you know, without stop. And then, so I think that's part of what the time was like, right? Mm-hmm. And then there was the idea that, okay, if you make film, if you make a film, like film also has the possibility to be a work of a way to be involved in political and social change and in the, you know, in cultural life, you see, and that you shouldn't neglect that. It's not mere sheer entertainment and distraction, you see. And we sort of bought into that in some ways. Then the people who were ahead of me, they also had the idea that, okay, what should happen is, okay, now we have access to this university education. And there was the attempt to inculcate the value that, okay, but don't lose the link to the people who nourished you and what brings you here and who in some ways made this opportunity possible, and don't share in it. So how do we connect what we're learning, be it law or psychology or sociology or history or whatever, like how do we sustain and build the links and share this in the wider community, black community, right? Mm-hmm. And so they organized initiatives like that, along with other young people in the arts who wanted to be actors, who wanted to have theater, who wanted to have dance, who wanted to have music, and that kind of thing. And so in doing that, they made links with the wider black community in Los Angeles, you know, that nourished, fed, and provided us, right, with people that we could work with who were in some ways on the same mission. And if you came to, like, I'm in a kind of second group of them, a third group, actually. And what happens is by the time I came, they had developed, quite a number of people, connections with a number of people, and people had acted in these student films. And then you had kind of built up a kind of company, a group of people that you could go to and appeal to them to appear in your film. They understood what you were asking them to do. They understood, you know, that in some ways you were beginning, and they were apt to be bored for long stretches while they were waiting, right, for you to prepare the scene or the action or whatever it was that you were doing. They, they were able to tolerate that, and they gave a lot to those films. So part of the story of those films is in what I'm expressing, I hope, that was sort of how it happened.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, that was, I mean, it just seemed really marvelous that you were able to step into this particular environment that already had been established. I mean, you didn't have to set it up. I mean, it already existed. So the support was there for your artistic work. And I was wondering who was there when you arrived, because I was just sort of been going to all the films, and I have, like, I mean, I already knew Julie Dash's work and Haile Gerima's work and Charles Burnett's work, but I didn't know Larry Clark and Vin Caldwell, oh my goodness, and Jamal Monica and Ali Sharon Larkin and Zanabu Irene Davis. I mean, oh my goodness.
Well, a lot of those people you named, with the exception of the woman you named near the end, they were here. Jamal Fanaka and others, they came. He, Ben, and a number of other people came after Haile, Charlie, Larry, and those people.
Mm-hmm.
But they were not so far, you know, apart in age experience and that kind of thing. Sometimes they might be older, but they were just returning to school or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah. The others were ahead of you in the course. And it was, I can maybe, this is something that I'm noticing with storytelling. It's like you can oversimplify things and you can remove the complexities in order to have a kind of coherent narrative. And what's missed in that is that it was a process and it was a kind of struggle, and you kind of had, okay, the conditions were there, but to actually realize them, okay, you had to earn that, you had to contribute, you had to be involved, you had to seek it out.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, I want to acknowledge that because they had gone before and they had done it before, that in some ways it did exist. And in some ways, what I'm telling you is we recognize that in hindsight.
Oh.
And it's a matter of wanting to acknowledge it, because if you don't, then you kind of can exaggerate how clever you were, and things just kind of happen like that. But a lot of people gave up their Saturdays and their Sundays, you know, who are not known or recognized until the films are seen, and then people go, wow, but it's like maybe too late, right, in terms of them having any major benefit from it. So that's why I think it's important to acknowledge it, and then we share that. Those relationships, you know, if you had, if I inherited actors from Hailey, from Larry, and all of those people, which I did, then I'm kind of responsible to maintain and sustain that relationship so that Alile can have access to the same person. If I ruin it, then my reputation in the community is not so great, and also I let down on what I was given. That was sort of a kind of ethics that I think prevailed in that community, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like there was an initiation kind of process as well.
There's a kind of, there's initiation, and Haile Gerima used to say, don't talk of film, show a film. And also because you came into a situation where they were struggling and they had, maybe they had gone through it and they knew what you had to do, and sometimes they were your teaching assistant or whatever. And they kind of, your initiation was to go ahead and do what you had signed on for. And we'll help you and we'll support you, but you need to do it. And I think encouraged and made possible for more of us to complete that part of it than if that had been absent, certainly.
I was just thinking, besides most of the films being really interdisciplinary, I mean, you know, the film that you've got, The Pocketbook, which is going to, I believe, screen with, Bless Their Little Hearts, this Thursday, the 11th at PFA, it's based on, you know, a Langston Hughes poem, and then secondly, I was just thinking about these films, which is what I love about them so much, is that they're set in the community. I mean, we're in Compton, you know, we're in Watts, you know, we're in the Black community, we're in people's homes, and these people are people that we live with. So it's just like, wow, but it's a movie. I mean, you know, it's like on a screen, and it's big, and it's, but it's familiar.
Well, that was part of the effort, you know. And also, Watts loomed large in the imagination of the, you know, the country and the world because of it. What happened in 1965, but also a lot of initiatives around culture were started in Watts, and even sometimes we weren't fully aware of all the connections in history, but it had a kind of meaning, you know, and a kind of thing in our imagination and in the social and political world of the time, right? So I think that's why, you know, if we had been in another place, maybe another place, right? But that was where the people were. The films are actually a pretty good mapping of the city and a kind of geography that one is reminded of when you watch them, if you know the city, how much of it they actually represent or display, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one good thing about them. Actually, in this man Tom Anderson's film, Los Angeles Plays Itself, one reason he values them is because they show places and parts of the city that are sort of off the grid or outside the imagination of the tourist board and, you know, the sort of romantic image or whatever that's, you know, given to the world through Hollywood movies and TV shows, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was kind of a way to include them. And then we had colleagues who were Japanese-American, Mexican-American, and others, right? We had a young Vietnamese woman. We had foreign students. They were a big part of our education from Iran and Egypt and all those, and Africa and all of that. They did a lot to educate us, to encourage us, to, you know, and working together with them and the progressive white students at the school. It was a radical kind of school and a good school. It was a people's school. So we had all of that. And while this thing talks about L.A. Rebellion and sort of focus on this African-American group and community, we all acknowledge and have said always publicly that it was broader and richer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's not rich and broad in itself and central and important to understanding the country and the place and the whole and the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But we just acknowledge that because it's true. And we're not sure that without those people who were part of our third world cinema club and all our debates and things, you know, that the films would have been as rich as they are.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. And then it wasn't just specifically African American either. It was, you know, Pan African, because you had students from the Caribbean and Afro-Caribbean and Africa, like you already mentioned, and Europe, and, you know, African people of African descent from throughout the diaspora were a part of, you know, these various schools that, you know, you came in on the third wave, I believe you said, or the second wave.
Yeah. That's important because, but that's a part of the, that was a part of the discourse and part of the culture of the time, you know, the idea of the third world, the idea of our connection to Africa, to Latin America, to all of those things, you know, it's part of the inheritance from people like Langston Hughes and from the Negritude people and from others. Yeah, we were fortunate in that at that time in school, you could learn that. You had courses, you had people, you had an interest in the wider world in that way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed really holistic.
And that was rich.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our reality, you know.
Right, yeah, and it certainly comes through, you know, through in the films that, you know, we've been, you know, able to see and experience over the course of, you know, since September through the end of this month, which is just really fabulous. Wonder if you could talk a little bit about your relationship, you know, with Charles Burnett and your film Bless Their Little Hearts, which is a classic, and there's it's a restored print, so it's looking even better than it looked, you know, when it was last seen, you know, in this current edition of it.
No, he's a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
I met him at school here, and what happened was we worked together at the end of that small film, the pocketbook film.
Mm-hmm.
He helped me. He shot the latter part of the movie. So, but he was around, and at the time he worked, so he only came in the evenings to edit his thesis film. So it was difficult to meet him. Eventually I met him. We became friends, and over time we spent a lot of time talking. And what happened was, it tended to happen because of personalities and different things. A lot of our sort of those figures like Larry Clark, Hailey, Charles, Ben, and other people, you inherit that position and responsibility toward the people that come after you. Some of us do it better than, we're able to do it better than others, but it was a kind, they kind of, you sort of gravitated towards some who became sort of like mentors without having, you know, official responsibility or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so some gravitated to Hailey, some gravitated to Charlie, some gravitated to Ben, some gravitated to Larry. And you might end up working with them directly. A lot of times, one thing you were encouraged to do when you come here is they say you only learn by working on films. So you work on films of others, and also what you do is you build a kind of sweat equity so that you're known as a person who's reliable, responsible, and willing to work on others' films. So when you need help, they work on your films, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the responsibility and the relationships that existed. It happened that I became sort of close with him, and eventually we were talking, and I was needing to make the thesis film, and I had different ideas, and I, you know, there were two expensive, ambitious, and different things. And eventually he told me, I have a story for you, and we can do this without, you know, a great deal of money, and but it would be a long film and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the story, and yeah, I'll do the script, and we'll do that thing. So that's how we came to do that film together.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So it was a gift and a challenge, as mm-hmm. usual with these people, because then you're obligated, if a friend gives you a gift like this, then you're obligated to try to fulfill on it or to treat it well and to, you know, to realize it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that raises the stakes in a certain way. And you hope at the end of it that you don't let them down. But that's also a motivation. So that's how we came to make that film, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in a note that I read, it says that the family that or the same Los Angeles community depicted in Killer of Sheep, which I have seen, is in your film, Bless Their Little Hearts. Could you tell us a little bit about what the story is, and how close is that story, the story that Charles Burnett shared with you, to some of your ideas that you were thinking about as you were approaching your master's thesis project?
Oh, what happened was, I think maybe what you read, okay, well, it's similar to Killer of Sheep in some ways, because what happens is there's a couple, and the couple has children.
Mm-hmm.
And this couple is played by a different actor, the husband,
mm-hmm.
but the wife is played by the same actress,
okay.
Casey Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And the children, who people confuse, they think they're Charles's children. They're his nieces and nephews. And what happened was the two older ones are in Killer of Sheep, but they're much younger. And then the little girl, Kim, their sister, she is new to the whole thing in the film. She's new. And she was a new little sister also.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first film for her.
Mm-hmm.
The story is basically the story of a worker, unskilled worker, a worker who might have had a factory job, and his wife, who also is a worker, and their three children. And what happened is the father becomes unemployed. We don't know exactly why, but he's unemployed when we meet him.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking for work, and he's, you know, going to unemployment office, and also he's picking up day jobs, you know. He's
mm-hmm.
picking up any work he can get and to contribute to the family. And, in fact, the family is largely being supported by the mother,
mm-hmm.
okay? and by the wife, Casey Moore plays this role. Okay, and the three children are school children, school-age children. The oldest girl, in some ways, is the one who takes care of the younger ones and takes care of preparing dinner and managing the house until the mother and father are back in the house, you know? So it's about what happens to a family, what happens to a couple, what happens to the people involved under the strain and stress of long-term unemployment, huh? And the you know, expulsion of these people from the labor force. Now, what was happening at the time leading up to the film was that a lot of the major manufacturing industries in Los Angeles area were releasing thousands and thousands and thousands of unskilled and semi-skilled workers, right? And that was a job that you could raise a family on. You could maybe get a modest house. You could pay your bills. You could send your kids to school, you know. And you could have some hope for the future. And so that was given. That was reality in the city itself, right? And what was happening was being noted in part in, you know, different ways. But in the black cinema, in cinema, there was not so much talk about this. And even among the schoolmates, the particular Charles was the one who had the closest links to that kind of situation. But he's a poet, and he was interested also that the other film, Killer Sheep, has a lot of history inside, you know. And this film, I think it has some of the, you know, the links to all of that. But at the same time, it was taking on an issue that was sort of central, but it's not simply topical. It also has a kind of history behind these people, who they are, where they come from, that kind of thing. Even if it's not telling you all of that, it informs the tone, the mood, and that kind of thing, right? And I think that interests me for sure. And also making a film about working class people to assert the culture, the values, the, you know, the things of the black working class people in a creative way. Well, it interests me. That was my interest. Okay. And so that way, it was a way to make a film that was in part about that and in part in solidarity with people in that kind of situation, you know, that they're interesting, they're valuable, they're beautiful, they're, you know, they struggle, they suffer, they make mistakes. And that also the struggle for a couple to maintain, you know, their relationship under the strain of the larger demands, you know, economic, familiar demands, and all that kind of stuff, raising your kids, right? Mm-hmm. Those very real things. So I was lucky to have such a story.
Right.
And so that's how, you know, that's the part of it that interests me.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I was just thinking that, I was wondering if perhaps, you know, growing up in Texas and coming to Los Angeles, you know, there are a lot of Southerners that migrated to California for a variety of reasons, and the idea of employment, you know, being able to take care of one's family, is a theme that runs through of quite a few of the films that are part of the program LA Rebellion. Because I think about the film of the one I saw last week by Manona Wally, The Gray Area, and it's about a man who I believe just getting out of prison.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Black Panther Party, and he's trying to find a job, and it's
sure.
real different outside. I think he'd been in prison for like 7 years.
Yeah.
And he couldn't find anything. And then another film that I saw maybe a week or so before that, and I think it might have been a woman director, it was about this young man who had graduated from high school and wanted to go to college, and his mother was a domestic worker, and she wanted him to get on with the factory,
yeah.
and he wanted to be an attorney.
Yeah.
And then she just has an epiphany. It's like, no, I'm not going to work when my son is graduating, so she decides to go to his graduation. And then she says, no, he's not going to be available, you know, to work in the factory. He's going to college, because she was just looking at how the woman she was working for was so proud of her son and his accomplishments and didn't know this woman at all, you know, her
I
internal
think that,
life.
Mm-hmm. That's a film by Toriano Berry.
Yeah.
He's the younger one. He comes later.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Right, right.
Yeah.
It's called Rich.
Yeah. That's a charming film.
It
yeah.
is. Mm-hmm, it was. And then Shipley Street is also really charming as well. I mean, that.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
yeah
you buy
nice
Jacqueline
film.
Frazier.
Mm-hmm. It's a very nice film.
Yeah.
Well, they. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they may, you know. They come a little later, but they it's amazing how much life and how many of these issues they raise without being sort of, you know, they're not just solely about those issues, but they're how people contend with life, you know.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah. They contend with life, and then they overcome. I mean,
yeah.
they rise above it, which is so hopeful.
Yeah. Sometimes they overcome, but the reality is. If they stay in the struggle, you know,
mm-hmm.
that then that's its own has its own value, because you may not overcome in the short term,
mm-hmm.
but maybe the, you know, you set the conditions, you don't give up if you mm-hmm. you hope, you see.
Right. Yeah. And then I just loved Emma May, Jamal Sonica's film about this girl who, you know, came, you know, from Mississippi
yeah.
and to Los Angeles, and how she organized her friends. You know, the cause was, you know, well intended, but, you know, the folks were, they didn't deserve all that honor. But, you know, organizing her friends to create a business and to raise money,
yeah.
and then they did so well, and then the racial paradigm, you know, shut them down because they
yeah.
were doing so well. I'm like, well, and then that is so true. I mean, back then and now too.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites of his films.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the films. But, you know, yeah. But, I mean, you know, Los Angeles is the black community is a large part. A lot of it, you know, have their origins in Louisiana and Texas. So
mm-hmm.
it's not so unusual. Mississippi is more unusual, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
they are here too. Arkansas people, but, you know, that's largely where that population comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And then, you know, that Southern flavor is, it has, you know, the immigrants bring with them, even generations later, a certain type of a flavor and a certain type of values that are different than
I
those.
Think,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, as the way that works is they're migrant people, so what happens is, and partly that's the films that construct that. You have to value that to recognize and acknowledge it. And not all northern and western and urban people, and also the generations who are born here,
mm-hmm.
they don't know that. In some ways, that's in Charles Burnett's films and in other films, because we sort of insist and we recognize it or we value it somehow. Not all the films have that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool, because not all the people share that experience, you know.
Okay.
They are people, young people who are born here. They don't know anything about that. And that can be good and that can be bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah, but we, you know, you talked about an inheritance, and I'm from New Orleans, and
yeah.
my children are born here, and so what I bring, because I was raised here, so I don't, I mean, so it really is more intuitive than I actually bring something, because my parents are the ones that instilled in me those values. So I have to instill those values in my children and connect it up for them. Like, well, even if you don't know the people, this is where it comes from.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, it's rich. And it's like how the tradition and what do you call it? The new thing that they are confronted with, that kind of thing. It's something that people have to work out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It used to be more pronounced because the way of transportation, communication, and all of that has been revolutionized. So everybody see the same shows, try to speak the same way, try to, mm-hmm. you know, move the same way. And if they don't go back and forth, and even if you go, you find the same thing, same music, same style, same everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways it belongs to an earlier period.
Right, yeah.
Part of the world is, you know, it's collapsed in the time and the space so that you don't experience this difference so dramatically, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But people have to decide if there are things of value in that. The fortunate thing is when people it still exists to some extent, and it used to be more prevalent, and it was partly what we could learn from the transition from tradition to modernity
mm-hmm.
in other places, in African films and in films from other parts of the world where the transition is more clear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The distinctions still exist. And then you start to value and wonder about how to look at your own situation and if those things pertain, you know? So that's part of the richness of what film could do at the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now the challenges may be different or whatever. Mm-hmm. We have to figure it out, and the younger ones have to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Right, so. Yeah. But it's a good thing that everything is not homogenized.
Yeah.
Or pasteurized even. I noticed that, you know, you mentioned that, you put in cinema sweat equity so that, you know, when you wanted to call in, you know, call in, you know, look at, you know, sort of your bank account, you'd have something there on the books. And so I noticed that you are actually in the film that Charles Burnett directed, When It Rains, and that's going to be not this week, the 11th, but the 18th when you're back in Los Angeles. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, being in front of the camera, you know, being an actor.
Oh, no, that was fun because, and I say I only do that for him. Other people ask me, but I don't do it. I'm not, you know, I was never aspiring or interested in that. But with him, he asked us to do it, and it's a very special thing because most of those people are friends.
Mm.
And they are friends that he got a commission to make this thing for French TV. And so he called, he told us, oh, I'm making this thing, and I think this is what this is what I'm doing, and so I want you to, I'll give you a role. And it's just as simple as that. I mean, Charlie asked you, and it's a chance to do it, and also other friends like John Rear, the guy who plays the guy who wants to propose to kill the guy and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He's an old friend from school. So in some ways, it was like the old days and it was our thing. I mean, he made that after making the other films, To Sleep With Anger and he was like a small project he made in between for French television.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with it, and yeah, for Charlie, yeah, no doubt, you do it. And it's fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So you don't think about it, you do what he asks you.
Mm-hmm.
And you hope you do it okay, you know.
Yeah. And what are your films, what films have you made since Bless Your Little Hearts and Bless Their Little Hearts? And I know you teach at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television.
I teach at California Institute of the Arts.
Oh, you do?
I've taught there for 25 years.
Oh, okay. So you know What about Leo Smith?
I know him very much. He's making a score for a film I'm trying to make.
Oh, seriously? Yeah, I spoke to him last year about the masterpiece, the opus he did for on the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10 Freedom Summers.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know him well.
Oh, wow. So
and
So...
Oh, what happened was, like a lot of us, I was sort of interrupted in this filmmaking thing. I prepared another project. It didn't happen. Let's leave it at that. So what happened is then I had to get back to it. So what I did is I started making things that I didn't have to ask anybody. I started to make the small video projects. And then in 1990... what was it, 99 or something like that, a friend got a commission to make a work about the building of the Frank Gehry's Disney Concert Hall. So for 5 years I made this video documentary kind of project about the building of that concert hall, which is a big, you know, cultural symbol of the city and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so for 5 years, I made a work about that called The Architect, the Ants, and the Bees. So what it's really about is the people who actually, the workers who actually build the building. And you see them building the building from the hole in the ground all the way till the finish of it, you know, with ellipsis and all that in between. So then we had an exhibition of that work, and then I've been working on another documentary film for some time. Hope to finish it next year.
Is that the one that Without a Leo Smith is doing the score for?
Yeah, he will do some music for it. Yeah.
And I guess you can't tell us what it is until you finish it?
I shouldn't talk about it.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, hopefully we'll be in touch and you can let me know once you can talk about it.
Yeah, for sure.
That'd be awesome.
I'm not being coy. I just really shouldn't talk.
Oh, no. Yeah. I understand. I mean, I would have been surprised if you would have talked about it, but I always ask just in case.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much
for this wonderful
conversation. It was really lovely, and looking forward to meeting you tomorrow. Are you in the Bay Area, or are you flying up later on?
I'm coming up tomorrow.
Okay. Excellent.
Okay.
Well, have a safe journey.
Thank you very much.
You take good care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. So that was an interview with director Billy Woodbury on the occasion of the Pacific Film Archive series L.A. Rebellion. And I did get a chance to meet him and other directors that came up for that screening about 4 years ago. So you should look him up because the film that he spoke of is probably finished now. So we're going to close with an interview with director Lavinia Currier Oka. And the film looks at an American living with African Bayaka group in Central Africa.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated with that region, Central African Republic, and the whole rainforest. And it's really interesting that when I first found out about the Central African Republic was when President Aristide was kidnapped and flown there. And I'm like, oh, and look at there, that film is right there.
Yeah, most people, when you say Central Africa, you say, where'd you film Central Africa? And you go, what country? You say Central African Republic. What country? You know, nobody has heard of it.
Right, right.
And we had a really interesting trip. We took the film back to show it to the Pygmies in August.
Lovely. Nice.
And we ended up having our first screening in the forest for them. And then we screened in the town where we had, you know, where most of the people working on the film had come from. And then we screened all the way up in the capital, and the last screening was for the president. We brought our actors up, and that was really, really interesting. Very interesting. And then they decided, it was a co-production with Central Africa, and they decided to submit it for the Foreign Oscars, but the Foreign Oscars said it's not 100% Central African, so we're arguing about that now. But just to
Oh, because you, you
because got... I have citizenship of Central Africa.
You do.
Mm-hmm. But the Oscars considers me to be American, which I am.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're squabbling about it a bit, but I think we'll lose because after all, they can do what they want. The Oscars, you know, they don't have to.
Oh wow! So how did you get citizenship in Central African Republic? Because you know Louis Sarno?
No, although Louis is a citizen, he became a citizen several years ago. I think it was because I've been working in that country for some time and then making the film. The Central African Republic wanted it to be a Central African production.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a kind of an honor that they gave me. I'm happy to have it.
Yeah, that was really awesome. So talk about your relationship with Louis and how you came to meet him and learn of his story 12 years ago.
I went to Central Africa and met Louis because somebody and a friend in New York said, you know, if you're going to, I was casting for another film. Do you know the story of Otobenga?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, is he Central African Republic?
No, he was from the Congo.
Okay. Oh,
but
in the same region.
Well, same forest, you know, same great big forest, but it's actually like 1,000 miles away. But I co-wrote a script with a wonderful novelist, Ricky Ducournay, about Ota's story.
Yeah.
Which, as you know, is an incredibly sad story.
Yeah.
But what interested me about it was that it took place at the time that we were just beginning our industrial experiment, right? Like Teddy Roosevelt pushed a button in Washington and all the lights went on and the fair in St. Louis lit up and they had 1,000 Aboriginal people there. And so it was like this great industrial power. And I thought it would be really interesting to show that through the eyes of someone who was completely different, you know, who's from Africa, who had no family, no power, no interest in any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we wrote a script, and I loved the script, and anyone who read it, you know, would cry and say, this is so sad. Mm-hmm. So I went to Louis, and I said, you know, I want to find a guy who can act this part.
Yes.
And I found one, thanks to Louis.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man from the forest and Babongo, and he had filed teeth. And but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that making that film and bringing him to make the film, I would be doing more or less the same thing that was done to Otobenga. I would be taking him out of his context.
Mm-hmm.
He would be in the winter in New York in the snow.
Yeah.
And Virginia and so on and so forth. So I had a little misgiving about it, and then 9/11 happened. Financing was tough because we had to build the World's Fair, so it was not a small budget film. And then there was another film that was made that was about another story, a very similar story involving pygmies in Scotland.
Mm. What's it called?
It was called Myth to Man. It was a French film by the guy who did Indochine.
Oh.
And it was, I saw it and I was like, oh, this is so depressing. And so I went back to Louis and I said, Louis, let's make something, these people are so positive, let's make something positive, a slice of life that shows as much as we can, as me as a white American, as much as we can get out of the way and show what their life is like, both in the village and in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis said, well, I have this memoir, but I don't know where it is. I think it's in my mother's storage in New Jersey, and I'm sure you won't like it. You know, he's a very self-deprecating guy.
Yeah.
And I tracked it down, and I finally managed to get it to print out, and I read it, and I was laughing. And it's like so many funny stories of this guy, fish out of water, who wants nothing more than just to be part of this people's community.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, first don't tolerate him, and then they tolerate him, and then he falls in love, and then he becomes a member, and now he's like almost an elder because he's seen so many generations come and go.
Right.
Anyway, so Louis agreed to write a script with me.
Oh, nice.
And incredibly, you know, often when people decide to have films made about them, about halfway through they kind of panic and go, oh, I don't want this after all. It's such a vulnerable thing.
Yeah.
But he's been great. I mean, he's been really... I think he thinks that the film can be helpful to the community.
Oh, yeah,
and
certainly.
We hope to use it in a positive sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of ways it could be helpful. It could be helpful looking at sort of the impact on the environment,
right,
and the community,
right,
of industrialization and you know, just sort of how, you know, you've got, you know, China is so present in Africa,
mm-hmm,
and so in that, mm-hmm, one character, he sort of represents the country,
mm-hmm,
and how China is undermining traditional culture,
mm-hmm,
around, you know, making cloth and,
mm-hmm,
doing the weaving,
mm-hmm,
because you can get it cheaper,
right,
if you buy it in China,
right.
So what do people do when they go to the market?
We were setting up a screening at the UN before the New York opening,
mm-hmm,
and it was canceled because of the Chinese character.
Oh.
They said that was not going to fly with the UN. Isn't that interesting? He's so mild. We cut him down to almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was Chinese, but he could have been French or Lebanese, or,
mm-hmm,
but they wouldn't show it for that reason.
Wow, that's interesting.
Hit a nerve.
And then the mayor, he's more iconic. I mean, he represents,
mm-hmm,
neocolonialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was amazing. We don't go to the forest anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We live in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And the boombox, and, you know, trying to be Western,
mm-hmm,
you know, I'm like, wow, that is so amazing.
Mm.
Yeah, that was really great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, because not everybody gets those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when Larry realizes, and that was so cool, like the magic in the film,
mm,
how his chief calls him.
Mm.
He's in America, and, mm, he is called him, and he's sleeping, he's awake.
Mm-hmm.
And still getting these visions.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I'm like confused, like, okay, is he on the operating table, and he gets off the operating table and goes?
Mm-hmm.
Or, because, you know, you go back and forth.
The alternate reality.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's really interesting. But I do get that he hears the music,
mm-hmm,
he hears the call, he sees the his chief talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
That is really cool.
Oh, good.
I really like that. That is like, because... in a lot of cultures that are not, have not lost their ability to communicate in other dimensions,
mm-hmm,
that are not so reliant on,
mm-hmm,
like telephones and things like that.
Right.
I think about the Aborigines in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't talk with their mouths; they,
mm-hmm,
talk with their minds,
mm-hmm,
and they sing with their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of thinking about that when.
No, the Bayaka are very much like that.
Mm-hmm.
You feel that when you're with them. It's like, wait. What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
You just get little inklings that, you know, it's,
yeah,
not what it seems.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And then, you know, when he decides to go into the forest, I'm like, wow, all by himself.
Yeah.
And he stops, and I'm like, okay, he's listening for direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think he's doing. I'm not,
mm-hmm,
sure. But I just think that's really cool,
mm-hmm,
these different dimensions that you have your character in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
That's really,
oh,
and,
good.
And it's not, doesn't seem as if it's imaginary or that you're making,
mm-hmm,
it up,
mm-hmm,
but we don't ever think about it like that.
Mm-hmm.
That there are other ways to look at reality than,
mm-hmm,
the ones we look at,
mm-hmm,
reality. And there's so many dimensions that we're not able to tap into because, you know, with a kid with a boombox, it's just too noisy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that's a real cool.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the film on such a more subtle level than most people do. Maybe
I watched it 3 times.
Oh.
Oh. Yeah, because I just wanted, because you can't get it. I mean, like,
mm-hmm,
it's really dense.
But it's interesting because when we showed it at Telluride and had some people say, well, you know, that protagonist, you know, the main character, he's just not that compelling, he's not that passionate about what he does. And when we showed it in Africa,
mm-hmm,
every single screening, somebody said, we're so glad that the white guy is not, like, rushing in and saving the day. He's not, like, the superhero that has all the answers. And,
mm-hmm,
and they said, we're so glad to see, finally, a white hero that he's, like, he doesn't know what to do, and he's kind of helpless, and...
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, even the little people have to save him and show him how to eat and so on.
Yeah.
Every single screening, somebody commented,
mm-hmm,
that they were just sick of having these white American heroes come solve everything for,
mm-hmm,
them.
Right.
So,
yeah,
it's interesting cultural difference, because I'm sure we're going to get criticisms here of, like, he's not strong enough, you know,
mm-hmm,
he doesn't care enough about, you know, saving everybody. And,
mm-hmm,
and Louis liked that. He just wants to be with those people and like those people as much as he can.
Mm-hmm.
He really loves them and he loves being there, and he's not trying to save them.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't pretend that he could. You know, he's not like missioned that way.
Right, yeah. I was really wondering, how did the character Louis's character, how did he become so fluent in the language?
Well, you know, he's an English actor, Chris Marshall, and
yeah.
English actors are text-based. You know, their training is Shakespeare, and they
yeah.
have a tremendous amount of text.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the way he kind of got the character.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I kept saying, it doesn't matter, you know, this is not a film about dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's spend time in the forest, spend time with... But he really wanted that language.
Mm-hmm.
That was his kind of security in
yeah.
the part.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, you know, Louis has learned the language, and I want to be able to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his thing.
Right, yeah.
Whereas, interestingly, the other good thing about British actors is that no matter how sick he was, he showed up for work.
Oh, he got sick for real?
Oh, yeah, he got very sick.
Wow, and how in character was that? Huh?
Yeah, and he lost a lot of weight. He was like,
oh,
Lavinia, I've lost a stone. And I was like, oh, don't lose another stone. You know, but he was so strong, and just sometimes he would just be lying on a bench and say, just, you know, say, Chris, you can miss a day of work if you want. You don't have to be
mm-hmm.
here. And he said, nope, it's my job. You know,
wow.
just
mm-hmm.
call me when you're set up. And
yeah.
incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think an American actor would have said, I don't care what you pay me, I'm out of here.
Yeah, union, whatever, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah, sue me if you want. I'm taking the next plane home.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just so workmanlike and really liked learning that language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I thought that the term pygmy was sort of pejorative and
mm-hmm.
insulting. So what do the Bayaka people call themselves?
They call themselves Bayaka.
Oh, okay.
And there are different, you know, Bayaka is a group of pygmy people in that region. It's about 20,000.
Okay.
And then about 1,000 miles to the east,
mm-hmm.
there's another group, which are Ituri, and they're different.
Oh, yeah, I know the Ituri.
Ituri and the
yeah.
Efe and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's funny because when we first were casting for Otebenga,
mm-hmm.
I put out a casting call on the internet for a pygmy in Los Angeles, and I got so much reaction from African Americans.
Oh.
Pejorative, you don't
oh.
use that word. But in some, as far as like a group of people, there's no other word. You can say the individual language group, like Bayaka
yes.
or Ituri,
yes.
but when you want to like make the link between the Bayaka and the Ituri,
mm-hmm.
you have no other word but pygmy.
Oh.
In other words, the
mm-hmm.
smaller sized
mm-hmm.
original inhabitants of the forest.
Okay.
And they were the first inhabitants,
mm-hmm.
Like the Bushmen or, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Closely related to the South.
Mm-hmm.
But African Americans find it mm-hmm. a pejorative term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because there's a really wonderful person who he was killed in a car accident. His name is Belonga Cascalor, and he brought African dance to this
mm-hmm.
area of California. And he, Alonzo King lines contemporary.
Oh, yeah, I know Alonzo King.
Yeah, Alonzo, remember when he did that piece on the people of the Ituri Forest?
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
a beautiful,
mm-hmm.
beautiful production. Actually, I think he might be having something next week.
Really?
Yeah.
That reminds me, I should get in touch with him because I know his cousin, Clennon King.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, I went to Putney School, and his
oh.
cousin was a little bit older than me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he would like this film.
I should definitely get in touch with him.
And then, you know, the people that came here
right.
from the Ituri Forest,
yeah.
he's in touch with them.
Is he?
Yeah.
Because they've had a horrible time with,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fallout from the war in Rwanda. And people have been killed and in
mm-hmm.
some cases eaten by...
Eaten?
Oh,
oh,
yeah.
Oh.
There was a horrible, about 5 years ago, massacre of Ituri people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, but it's very hard to find a substitute for pygmy when you're trying to make that link,
mm-hmm.
but the Bayaka call themselves Bayaka.
Okay, yeah, I was just wondering. And you know, when you were mentioning the Otebenga, I was thinking about Sarah Bartman,
mm-hmm.
And her story
mm-hmm.
of, you know, being on display
mm-hmm.
in a museum,
mm-hmm.
You know, as, you know, he was on display in, you know, at the World's Fair.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. So
did you read the Sarah Parks?
Yes.
It's called Hottentot Venus?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And you know, that we've had several plays here
mm-hmm.
in the Bay Area. And
mm-hmm. Have you seen them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
I read it, but I didn't see it.
Yeah, the plays have been really remarkable.
Mm.
Susan Laurie Parks.
Mm-hmm. Susan Laurie Parks.
Yeah, that was really nice. Yeah. And then there's a book. It's really sort of a lyrical story of her, the woman who did the poem at President Obama's inauguration.
Oh.
She wrote a book.
Oh.
About
right.
Sarah Bartman.
Right.
Really nice.
Well, when I talked to the Bayaka about that story about Otumbenga, they said, "That is a terrible story. Who would want to tell that?" And I said, "Well, we tell these stories so that we learn and we don't repeat them, and we're aware that they're terrible." And they said, "We forget terrible stories."
Yeah, less stress.
It's interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It really is. So, tell me about this wonderful cast, and you know, particularly, you know, some of the main actors, like the couple, you know, the leader of the community and his wife. And
well, Sitaka, whose real name is Mapumba, is in fact the real thing. I mean, he really is. They don't have a shaman. They don't point to someone and say, "There's the shaman."
Yes.
But he is a medicine man. He knows how to use medicine, and he's a remarkable person. He's quite old.
How old is old?
Now, they don't know how old they are, but Louis thinks he's probably 70, which is very old for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, I met him in the forest, in very much in a scene like the one we did with the antelope when they go into the hut.
Yeah.
He was living in a place like that.
Mm.
And he was wearing a similar jacket, an English riding jacket. He just had the most amazing presence. And I never thought he would do the film.
Mm.
I never thought he would do it. And I invited him to come, and I said we were doing some theater games and exercises, and if he was interested, he could sign up for a couple of days' work and see how it suited him. He was there. I mean, he was just, like, so focused and really amazing man.
Yeah, yeah. Is that his wife?
His real
wife? Oh, okay.
No. His real wife is very, very, very shy.
Oh.
Because they are forest people.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who plays his wife, Ikadi, her name is Asanja. She's from Congo. She's had a very hard life. She's childless.
Mm-hmm.
She's an amazing performer. And she had one of the really sweet stories on the film. During the shoot, she fell in love with the guy who she's now married to, younger man, and very handsome, very, you know, kind of desired by a lot of the women. The women are very forward.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, like the character that sort of approaches
very
Mary.
Very much so.
Uh-huh.
In fact, all the actresses or the women involved in the film, they would say, we've all chosen our American husbands. You know, it's like, we like that one. I like the French one. I like this. They're very upfront.
Mm-hmm.
But Mbombi, the actress, was the only one who had any sort of ego or star feeling. And that was because her boyfriend, who really became her boyfriend because she had an income on the film, decided to sort of manage her. So she really was like a little diva with a manager.
Uh-huh.
But everyone else, you know, it's a egalitarian, I'm sure you know, non-hierarchical, anarchistic society. And so there's no ego. We had three people for every part.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point where we, you know, realized that somebody didn't quite have the staying power or that it wasn't working well, we would just say, you know, we've decided that Mbanda's going to do it. And, okay, I'll just be here in case something happens.
Right.
You know, never any, hey, wait, that was my, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
Nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was this thing that Larry was looking for? I mean, he was an ethnomusicologist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his equipment, he had taped all this wonderful, these sounds of the forest, I mean, which were natural sounds, but they were musical.
Right.
I mean, washing the clothes, that was so nice.
Well, they drum the water. That's a women's thing, and it's an amazing thing.
It's
very hard to do. Mm-hmm. I tried to learn it, and I never got close.
Yeah, they laugh at me when I go to Africa and try to wash clothes, and I'm not trying to make a drum rhythm.
No, what they're doing is they're cupping the water and making a bubble, and then slapping the bubble with the other hand.
Yeah.
So you can vary the tone, because you can get a bigger bubble or a smaller bubble, depending on.
Wow.
Really difficult to do.
Yeah, that was really nice.
Yeah, that's neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, are we almost out?
Why don't you be aware of your time? It's almost 5:20.
We have 10 minutes.
Okay.
So, what were you asking about the...
I wanted to ask you about the this See, Larry was looking for something.
The Malemo.
Yeah, it was like this.
So the thing about the Malemo, I felt like he needed some quest that he was trying to get because he's going to die, and he wants to get the end of, he wants to finish his catalog, you know, typical Western collector.
Mm-hmm.
And the Malemo is a real instrument. It's died out because it was associated with the elephant hunt. The men used to play it before hunting an elephant and then in celebration of having killed an elephant.
Okay.
And now they're not allowed to kill elephants.
Yes.
So it's sort of died out.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting because when I first said, do any of you guys know about the Malemo? They said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody said, well, of course we used to know about it in a long time ago, but we don't hunt elephants anymore, so this is legend, like our grandfathers. And then time went on, they got to know us more, they started saying, of course we know the Malemo. In fact, we could bring you a Malemo, but we're not sure if we should or not. Because they're, you know, these are people that if someone hears that they've been poaching, they're brought into the gendarmerie and they beat the hell out of them. I mean, it's
they
not...
Do?
Oh, yes. They are so...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And if you can't find the guy that you think was the poacher, you bring his brother in and beat the hell out of him. And then sometimes they beat them to death.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they're very vulnerable. So it's not a joke when they say, you know, we don't know about this anymore. They're protecting themselves from being accused of somebody saying, well, if you know about that, that means you've hunted elephant. And, you know. So little by little, it came out that they knew this instrument quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And one day they made one just out of stuff around. That's where I realized that, you know, they don't have beautiful ivory things that they keep and carry around like other African groups like the Fang or you know, the incredible treasures that you see in museums. And they don't have things like that. They just use whatever they've got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a drum is a piece of a roof or a plastic bottle. So they made one of these, and that's where I got the idea to make it out of the pipe with, you know, decorating it with leaves.
Oh.
But the scene in which the Malemos played, they're also playing an instrument that Louis says is one of the oldest instruments on earth, and it's an earth bow. And there are places in the...
Yeah, you could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see it.
There are places in that region where the open land, I think it's glacial, it's hollow underneath.
Yeah.
And I don't quite know how that works geologically.
Yeah.
But there's only a couple of places. And so what they do, they know where those places are. They anchor a fiber string, you know, from a sapling like you see in the film,
yeah.
And then they pluck it like a bass, and it reverberates from the ground.
Yeah.
And the place we filmed was not a real place. It was slightly, you could hear it, but the place that Louis recorded it, that we use on the soundtrack, was a very famous place where it's completely reverberates. He calls it Bungingi Bai, onomatopoeic, Bungingi. And it's just an amazing instrument. I mean, even hearing the kind of fake one was really moving because you realize this is such an old instrument and you're playing the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really cool. First it's one person and then the other person. I'm like, wow. And it's like, and I'm thinking, it's not like solid under there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was really fascinating.
It's neat.
Yeah, and then all your beautiful scenes with the birds coming and all the animals.
Mm.
How'd you work that?
Well, we had a second unit camera that did only animals.
Ah.
And so a lot of that. And the last few days of filming were those days with the elephant. And I had actually planned to have an elephant hunt because the Malemo is supposed to come when you hunt the elephant. We weren't going to kill an elephant, but we were going to dart an elephant and do a fake kill. But what happened was that after working with the elephants, this is a group of elephants that have gotten used to the American researcher who's been there for 20 years. So we were kind of going on the goodwill that she'd accumulated with these animals, and they were pretty good to us. But after 2 days and kind of provoking them, getting them to run at us and run away from us, and they got tired of us, and the third day the crew said, we're not going back, it's dangerous. And it was dangerous. You could tell the elephants were just, you know, on the verge of getting rid of us. And so I had to you know, this is what happens in film shoots like this. You just have to adapt. I couldn't.
Ah.
I mean, I couldn't force my crew to go back there, and it was in fact dangerous. And we were almost at the end of the shoot. And no one had been killed.
Right.
And I just had to.
That doesn't usually happen, though. People don't get killed in your shoots, right?
Thank God. We had one accident.
Oh my.
Which was with the second camera. They were filming an elephant charged, and they ran from the elephant, and one of the guides ran right into a silverback gorilla. I mean, literally right into him, and the gorilla was very surprised, and he almost died.
Oh, the gorilla hit him or something?
The gorilla threw him to the ground and then savagely...
Oh, oh my.
Yeah.
On this particular film?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
wow.
It was scary.
Oh, so you were really were out there. I mean, for him to run into a gorilla.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you were out there with the.
Well, running into a gorilla, apparently. I mean, you couldn't do that if you. It just happened. It was just a bad.
Oh yeah.
Luck.
Because you have gorillas in this. And.
They weren't even filming a gorilla. It was just like an accident. But.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow, that is so fascinating.
But so the idea at the end is that, you know, it's amazing that how you picked up on the film, because that I wanted some of the way the Bayaka think about the forest to be in the script itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, I mean, they think magically.
Yeah.
And so when I talked to them about the Malimo, they started telling me stories about the Malimo, and more time went on, the more they started telling me. And they said... well, I said, where do you put the Malimo if you're not supposed to see it after you... and they said, oh, well, either we bury it in the ground, we can come back and get it, or we just throw it up in the air. And I was like, throw it up in the air? And they said, yeah. And so that's how I, you know, made that scene. And then the women later came to me and said, you know, the Malimo was actually our instrument and the men stole it from us. So, you know, it's these incredible layers of knowledge and myth.
Yeah.
And I can see why Louis, he's still there, you know, after 26 years. He says, you know, I feel so lucky. I'm living in a place, I come out, I hear a noise at night, I come out, and there's a leaf dancer, a spirit dancer in front of my house, and it's like I've never seen it before. He said, you know, every time I'm just like, stunned and surprised, and I think I'm so lucky to be here.
Yeah.
And you have that feeling with the Bayaka, you know, they just constantly surprise you in generally a really positive manner.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I know it's time's up, but sort of the whole cosmology of the Bayaka and being intruded on by Western culture. And the Bantu. That's interesting, the Bantu and the Bayaka, that whole relationship.
Very complex, and it dates back about 200 years. So they've had this trading relationship where the Bayaka would bring game from the forest and the Bantu would give them tools.
Okay.
And there would be some exchange of work. But the problem now, the Bayaka always had, when the Bantu abused them to a point, because the Bantu had them almost as slaves, they would... You know, when I first went 12 years ago and I said I wanted to meet some Bayaka, this Bantu guy said, well, I'll bring my Bayaka. You know, they all said my Bayaka because they would have them in the fields. But what's happened that's really dangerous for the Bayaka, they could always leave in the forest, and that was their freedom. And what's happened is, you know, as the forest gets cut and as their sources of meat get poached out, they can't leave. It takes them longer and longer to find food in the forest, and that's a really important thing, is that they need to be able to go in the forest, not only, you know, for their spiritual reasons, but also so they're not dependent on the Bantu. Because once they're in the village, they drink, and they take multiple wives, which is not part of their tradition. They do sorcery, which is not part of their tradition, which is, you know, really... terrible for them. You know, they take the ibogaine and they're paid to do it, and they do sorcery. And just beginning first cases of AIDS.
Oh my.
Because they've never had AIDS in their population. So it's so important that they have the forest as a means of independence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly.
Because really difficult to imagine the Bayaka being assimilated into Central African society. It's just, I've asked Louis, I was like, can you imagine? It's like, no, they'll be extinct.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Are you reissuing the book, Louis' book?
You know, I begged him, he wrote a book called Song of the Forest, which is available,
oh.
And I begged him to edit the manuscript that we used for the film script, Last mm-hmm. Thoughts Before Vanishing,
mm-hmm.
and he said, you know, I just don't have the energy for that, and I'm really sorry about that, because it's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to do something different and new, and
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Did I read correctly that that Louis' first book was published by City Lights, or did I misread that? And just
Penguin, but I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I know the issues that I had with Penguin.
Okay. All right.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
It's called Song of the Forest.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you.
It tells about his romance mostly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he did marry her.
He did.
And he has children.
He does, but she is on her third other husband.
Oh, yeah, we could sort of figure out that, yeah, that might happen.
Well, she just doesn't think he's a suitable husband. She loves him,
mm-hmm. Oh.
But she wants to be with Bayaka.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, he seemed to be okay with that when he was looking through the doorway of the hut. Like, okay, I still love you.
And that's true, he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow.